Well, now that the football season is over, it's time to reflect and refocus our attention on CPD. My name is Paul Santa Maria, and I'd like to welcome each of you to this morning's seminar on witness statements, tips, traps and pitfalls. Hard to say that so early in the morning. Our two presenters this morning are Chris Hansen and Toby Mullen, each of whom has impressive CVs, and you'll see that from the profiles in the packages that both of their practices are primarily commercial in nature, which is where witness statements are predominantly but by no means exclusively used. It's interesting to reflect upon the advent of witness statements in the commercial courts in the United Kingdom and in our own state since the 1980s, and also upon the varying attitudes to witness statements amongst judges of the Supreme and Federal Courts. Some of you might remember that in the 1980s, witness statements became the flavour of the month. It was thought that the preparation of tendering of witness statements would produce substantial savings of court time and legal costs, and that requiring parties to exchange evidence in advance would likely facilitate the resolution of cases prior to trial. After a period of time, however, some judges expressed real doubts as to whether witness statements saved any time because of the additional time taken in the hearing of objections and ruling. It was also thought that witness statements were an exercise of creative writing by the lawyers with familiar legalisms commonplace, so that witnesses who had never heard the words whereby and accordingly prior to meeting their lawyers suddenly discovered it was part of their own lexicon. Some witnesses were eviscerated in cross-examination because they didn't wish to own the statement naturally because they had such little involvement in the preparation of the statement. And that would often lead to awkward times in the giving of evidence for that witness. And I don't know of any paying client who thinks that witness statements have made litigation less expensive. Hence, over time, some commercial court judges have dispensed with witness statements, even over the protests of the parties who may have wished to use them, which is interesting. The judges, some judges, have felt that statements suffered not only from the vices to which I've referred, but also because it deprived them of the important opportunity of watching and listening to a witness give evidence in chief, and they felt that they were deprived of an important tool in their evaluation of the reliability, the credibility of a witness, where credibility was at stake. And I think a lot of them also have regarded it as unfair for a witness to be sworn in, to adopt their statement as being true and correct, seeing their own barrister sit down and then face cross-examination even before the witness has warmed up, like a duck in a shooting gallery. So that over a period of time, particularly in recent years, I think that we'd agree that there's been a bit of a shift away from certainly the automatic adoption of witness statements. Currently in the commercial list, and it might depend which particular judge in control of the matter, some judges simply refuse to have them. Some judges simply refuse to have court books as well. But the old attitude of call your witness, I want to hear the witness give evidence in chief and be cross-examined, I'm not going to look at witness statements. That is the attitude of some judges. And I think that Chris and Toby will agree that every lawyer in preparing a witness statement must warn their client to expect that the judge will direct the witness to put the statement down when it comes to recollection of significant conversations and to give viva voce evidence. And sometimes the witness isn't warned about that, and that can be really awkward too. Some of the common law judges simply will not have them at all. And I remember last year at a directions hearing in the major torts list, I politely inquired of the judge as to whether he would want witness statements. I wish I hadn't asked. Simply no possibility of witness statements being used in a common law proceeding. There's no doubt, however, that in the appropriate case, much time is saved with non-controversial matters and narratives by witness statement. But for the work in preparing them to be worthwhile and for the client's case to be properly presented, one must know how to draft witness statements properly. For this reason, this morning's papers are timely and I can recommend them to you. It's a generational thing, but both Chris and Toby are going to use PowerPoint presentations. I don't think I'd know what button to press, but there we have it. Can I welcome Chris to begin this morning's discussion?
Good morning. It's disturbing when we think PowerPoint is something of a technological advance, but there you are. Let me say first that I like the look of this bloke in the middle of the outline. He looks a lot like me, but much, much younger. Now, witness statements. You're all here because you find the topic riveting, or perhaps in a desperate search for a CLE point, but there's a degree of importance about it. In concept, I'm going to address two main areas. One, why do you do them? And two, what should they be? I'll be fairly general, and then Toby's going to give some more detail over various aspects. There's necessarily going to be overlap, but there's going to be overlap because some of these things are important. Now, why do you do them? The short answer is because you have to. As Paul said, essentially they're a creature of orders of the court. Traditionally, it was viva voce evidence, and then it was thought this was going to be simpler and more cost-effective. Entirely wrong. But there will be orders. If there are going to be witness statements, there will be orders. Now, obviously, you need to be familiar with the order. That's of particular importance if you're the person in the firm to who this has been handballed. Just draft the witness statements in this, will you? The order is going to contain things such as dates, and it's going to contain things such as whether witness statements are going to be exchanged or whether there are going to be statements in reply. And this can well make a difference to what you do. Exchange of statements, plaintiff and defendant, same time exchange of statements. In reply, it's usually plaintiff, defendant, and then statements in reply. And it might change what you put in if you know you're going to get another go up the track. The statements, they'll usually be in the order, and if not in the order, it's always in the practice note, that the statements stand as the evidence in chief unless leave's given to adduce further evidence. Now, I'm going to say a little bit more about that, but that is the crucial point about witness statements. They stand as the evidence in chief. In Victoria, as we all know, we're in a settlement culture. Very few things run to trial, and even less things run to judgment. And what that means is there are fewer and fewer people in the profession in Victoria who've actually run something through to judgment. And in a witness case, we've seen how the witness statements get used in court, what cross-examining counsel make of them, and what judges make of them. But the fundamental point to keep in mind is it's the evidence in chief. And I'll come back to that when I talk about persuasiveness later on. So you do them because the court tells you to. What should they be? Now, for simplicity's sake, I've got it down to 4 points. I say they should be adequate, they should be persuasive, they should be relevant, and importantly, they should be admissible. Adequate. It's not a very strong word, but it's there to say they should cover the pleaded case. I come back again to say evidence in chief. If you haven't ticked all the boxes for your pleaded case when the witness statements are finally done and dusted, then you've got a problem. It's like taking the witness through it in evidence in chief viva voce, get to the end, sit down, think, oh, geez, I forgot that. Yeah. It's got to be in the witness statements. The essential guide is the pleadings. So if you're in VCAT or if you're in the courts, you're going to have points of claim or a statement of claim. You're going to have a defence, whatever it might be. You will have elements you need to tick off. Typical commercial case, you've got an agreement and you've got the pro forma in the pleading, partly in writing, partly oral, partly to be implied. You need to cover it all off, partly in writing. On 12th of August, blah, 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 I signed a document. Exhibit the document. We also had conversations. I said to him, he said, it's all got to be in there. You need to know by the time the witness statement's finished that you've ticked all the boxes in the pleading. I've just referred to statements of claim. It's the same, of course, in defences. No, I've paid him. It needs to have some life in the witness statements. I made a payment of X amount on this date. Here's the cheque stub. Here's my bank statement. Here's where it cleared. We need to be comprehensive. There's a tendency, because these things take some time, there's a tendency to make it more of an outline. But no, it needs to be the sort of evidence that you would take your witness through if they were there in evidence in chief. It needs the detail. Importantly, witness statements need to be, there we go, persuasive. I'm labouring this point, but it is the main one. It is the evidence in chief. As Paul said, traditionally, you put a witness in the box, you take them through their name and occupation, and then you get to settle them down and you get to tell the story for the court. The witness settles down, the court gets to see the witness somewhat relax, and you get to massage that impression before cross-examination. One of the problems with witness statements is obviously you don't. Have you made a witness statement? Yes, I have. True and correct. Yes, it is. Over to you. So it's important that the witness statement is, how can I put it? It's an impression management tool, among other things, to make the witness appealing, to give their evidence some life, to generate some interest on the bench, to make it easy for the bench to read. Because witness statements are done in the sterile atmosphere of somebody's chambers or somebody's office, you can tend to forget that. You really should be looking at them from the point of view of the judge or tribunal member reading them. Why will it be appealing? How can I give this some structure? How can I make sure that the judge, A, reads it through to the end, and B, takes from it what I'd like them to take from it? So keep it in mind, it's not just a dry legal document. It's got some elements of storytelling about it. Sure, you have to do the things I said earlier. You need to tick all the boxes in the statement of claim or defence, but it should have some degree of readability, life and appeal about it. One of the classic mistakes is having the thing wordsmithed. You don't usually see herein before mentioned, thank the Lord, but you will see, when I signed the said contract, who says that? You're going to say, we had a conversation to the effect. Again, nobody says that. Again, in relation to persuasive and direct speech, if at all possible. I said to him and then he said to me. If, as is usual, the witness can't remember the direct speech, I don't remember exactly what he said, but I think it was something like that, but not conversation to the effect of. That just smacks of the lawyer drafting what he'd like the witness to say. Logical structure and progression, it's usually chronological, but not always. Sometimes you've got cases where you've got a number of issues and it's simpler to break it up with headings in the witness statement. This is what we say about agreement one, this is what we say about agreement two. But logical structure, again, make it easy for the court or tribunal. Almost all decisions are reserved, so the witness statement is part of the judge or tribunal member's take-home pack. Again, it's much easier if it's easy to use, it's much easier to write a judgment if the witness statement's easy to use, and it's much easier to look favourably upon your side of the fence if your witness statements are easy to use and the other side are incomprehensible or just difficult to get around. There will inevitably be annexed documents, almost inevitably, and sometimes that's all the witness statement is a vehicle for. Documents are going to be typically the most persuasive evidence, so make sure they're all in, make sure they're referred to, make sure you've sufficiently identified them such that this witness, doing this witness statement can actually put this document in. I signed this contract as opposed to George gave me this contract that he thinks somebody else had signed. Make sure that if you're exhibiting documents, make sure there's the relevant identification evidentiary chain that this witness can exhibit that document. Be careful of drafting what you wish the witness would say. It tends to happen. You have a conference with the witness, you take some notes, you go back to the witness statement, and it's not entirely elegant or perhaps not entirely helpful what the witness's recollection is. So there's a tendency to put in what you wish the witness would say. Yeah, beware cross-examination. It's what Paul said before, and quite often the witness will just walk away from the witness statement if they're feeling threatened in cross-examination. That didn't happen. My lawyer told me to put that in. It's all over. So beware of putting in what the witness would say. If it's unfavourable, it's unfavourable. Hell, it's not your case at the end of the day, and you have a duty to the court. Put in the witness's own evidence. Be careful about sticking everything in. Now, that's a difficult judgment call because, as all barristers will tell you, you never quite know what's going to get traction in the court. Sometimes the things that you think are irrelevant turn out not to be. But there's a judgment call between getting in anything that might get some sort of traction and just putting a lot in as if it's a narrative divorced from the legal process. So some judgment needs to be exercised. And as I said in the slide, sticking everything in lessens the impact of the good bits. If it's sharp, if it's to the point, it's much, much easier for the judge or tribunal member. And I keep coming back to that point, but that's what the witness statement is for. It's for the judge or tribunal member to make a finding in your client's favour. It's the vehicle for that. I said earlier they should be persuasive and tell a story, and that's it. They should tell a story. That's what you're doing. It's got consequences. It's got formalities, but you're trying to make it appealing, a good narrative, something that'll take the tribunal member or judge where you want them to go. What should witness statements contain? Relevant material will be good. Relevance, though, now, under the, I don't know that we should call it the New Evidence Act, but the Evidence Act is very, very broad. Something is relevant if it could rationally affect, directly or indirectly, the assessment of the probability of the existence of a fact in issue. It's not very elegant, is it? But it means, essentially, look, if on any view it could impact what I think about the probability of a fact, then it's relevant. Objecting on the basis of relevance now, given that definition, is pretty much dead. So relevance is very, very broad, but return to what I said a couple of minutes ago. It doesn't mean stick everything in. They should contain admissible material, and I'm going to skate over this to some degree because we could be here for days talking about hearsay. But the usual objection to items in witness statements, or a usual objection, is hearsay. The definition in the Evidence Act I've put up there, I'm not going to read it. It's cumbersome and it's difficult, but it's assisted by some of the examples which are given in the Evidence Act, and the definitions, section 59. They helpfully provide an example in the legislation. P had told W, we'll call it, Paul had told William that the handbrake on William's car did not work. Unless an exception to the hearsay rule applies, evidence of the statement cannot be given by Paul, William, or anyone else to prove that the handbrake was defective. You can't come along and say, well, I said that before, so that's the fact, or he said it to me, so that's the fact. And that sounds obvious until you see it in witness statements. It happens a lot in domestic building cases down at VCAT, where, for example, you'll usually have a husband and wife of the property owners in dispute with the builder, and the wife will own up to a witness statement, much of which is, my husband told me that the builder said, be careful. Now, sometimes it doesn't have enormous consequence in that things are just struck out. But if what is struck out is one of the essential building blocks for adequacy that I referred to earlier, so something that you need for the purpose of his statement or claim or defence, then you're in deep trouble. back to what I said earlier, the statement stands at the evidence in, as the evidence in chief unless leave is given to adduce further evidence, and leave is usually, if somewhat grudgingly, given. But beware, if something is crucial, if a factual item is crucial, make sure you haven't offended the hearsay rule. There are exceptions to the hearsay rule, and the typical one is first-hand hearsay. Now, first-hand hearsay is where someone has personal knowledge of the particular representation. Yeah, I heard Bill say that. And you'll be able to give evidence of that in a witness statement if the maker of the original statement's not available, section 63, or if the maker's available, it would cause undue expense or delay or not be reasonably practical to call them. And that's a judgment call, and you'll need material about whether that's going to apply. So if you're running a 25 grand claim in VCAT and you've got somebody who's in Switzerland on holiday, you're not bringing them back and you'll probably get up under section 64. If you're running $1.5 million in the Supreme Court and somebody's in Hong Kong, it's not going to work. People get on, and there's authority to the effect that people get put on planes every day to come and give evidence. So judgment call, depending on the nature of the case and why it is that somebody is it's not reasonably practical to call someone. You're supposed to give notice if you're going to rely on this exemption. I've always been unclear how this works in a witness statement case. It seems to me that the witness statement is notice in itself. If you've got the material in there, clearly you intend to do it. Just something for viva voce evidence, really. The last point is, if you do call a maker on the maker of a statement, so if you're putting in a witness statement for someone who says, well, yeah, Bill told me, you might be able to get in a somebody else to corroborate that as well. Just have a look at section 64.3. It's too technical, really, I think, to go into this morning with any degree of utility, but be aware of these exemptions in section 63, section 64, and if you've got any doubt while you're drafting, open the Evidence Act, have a look, ring your mate at the bar. Just be aware it's there for it to ring a bell if you're thinking, gee, I don't know, it's starting to look like hearsay. How can I get it in? Do I need to chase up somebody else to give an additional witness statement? Am I really confident that it fits within the exemption? That's the purpose of this slide and this morning's chat, essentially to send up the flare, to say, well, geez, it looks like hearsay, I'd better think about it and I'd better have a strategy. The most used, I think, possibly most useful exemption of hearsay is business records. And in a commercial case, you're going to see business records attached to a witness statement, statements of account perhaps, maybe diaries of people out on site. Business records are provided for in section 69 of the Evidence Act, and it has certain requirements, but they're records which form part of the records kept in the course of or for the purposes of a business. It's about as broad as it gets, really. In the course of or for the purposes of a business. It will include things like site diaries, and obviously it'll include formal documents, invoices, delivery dockets, that sort of thing. So if you're putting in documents and you're in any doubt, have a look at section 69, see whether it's a business record or not, and breathe easier. You may well have to put in the material to satisfy the court or tribunal that it is a business record. Sometimes it's self-evident, an invoice, a delivery docket, whatever. If it's a diary, it might be, this is a page from my site diary. I keep this every day when I am at work and I use it to record the things I do. So that you've ticked the boxes in section 69 and there's not going to be a debate about it. Again, in relation to documents, have a look sometime at section 48 of the Evidence Act. And section 48 is a facilitative section. It's quite long and it provides that you can adduce evidence of the contents of a document by adducing a copy, by adducing a transcript, by all the sorts of things that were difficult to do under the old Evidence Act. It gets rid of the formality of best evidence rule, let's try and put in the original document, and it essentially provides you to get into the witness statement or in viva voce evidence formal type documents, the sort of documents that really aren't going to be contentious, facilitated by section 48, so have a look at that. Lay opinion. often gets a Guernsey in witness statements. You call it conclusion. I thought he was drunk. That's a lay opinion. I thought he was going too fast. Again, that's a lay opinion. If it's based on what saw, heard or otherwise perceived kicker and is necessary to obtain an adequate account or understanding of the perception, then it'll be admissible, Section 78 of the Evidence Act. Be careful of it. It has to be necessary to obtain an adequate account or understanding, and the best evidence is always what someone saw, heard, otherwise perceived. I thought he was angry. Maybe not. Better to get in the speech. He said it this way. He said it that way. He said this to me. So be a little careful about lay opinion. It is an easy thing to do, but it's conclusionary. You're better off to be putting in the witness statements the building blocks. This is what he did. He walked into the room and he punched the wall. Credibility evidence. This is probably more particularly for building cases down in the tribunal. Owners typically want to say lots of bad things about builders. Now, while the tribunal isn't bound by the rules of evidence as such, they do have regard to them. Evidence that affects the credibility of a witness is not admissible except in cross-examination. That's a general proposition. So the stuff that the client or witness often wants to put in about how bad the other side is and how they've done this to other people and how there's various other things they've done, and they've got a lot of parking tickets, you know. No. At least you've got a chance. Well, two things. You've got a duty to the court to exercise your own judgment, but two, this gives you a reason to say to the client, no, I'm sorry, we just can't put that in. Privilege. And I'm getting to the end. You'll all be relieved to know. Privilege is also often a problem in witness statements. The one that's usually offended is settlement negotiations. So they'll be what we used to call without prejudice privilege. You will have exhibits of letters of offer to settle proceedings or to settle the matter. You'll have evidence of conversations about settling the matter. They are privileged and they shouldn't be there. There are two problems. They offend the privilege of the other side, and two, it waives your own privilege. So be careful about matters which might otherwise be privileged. Now, we've been rattling along, but the essence of what I had to say was, had I remembered to turn over the slide, why do you do them? Because you have to. In essence, look at the orders and look at any practice note. There will always be a practice note. The green book in the commercial court has some pithy things to say about witness statements. A witness statement in written form is the evidence that a witness would otherwise give orally, and subject to contrary order when adopted stand as the evidence in chief of the witness, point I'm making before. And it provides some requirements as to how they're numbered and what's in them, but it's in essence what I've been saying. Make it persuasive, make it admissible, crucially make it useful for the judge or tribunal. Tribunal practice notes also contain similar things about witness statements. So have a look at the order, have a look at the practice note. The four points: they should be adequate, persuasive, relevant and admissible. And finally, it's either by way of a plug for business or a beware, if you have a doubt, talk to somebody at the bar. I think before you finally come to the final form of a witness statement, it's a good idea to send it to the counsel who's going to be at the trial or hearing. A, they do a lot of it and they have the expertise. B, they're going to be the one who's stuck with it at the trial. So if you're not having counsel formally settle them page by page, or ideally having counsel draft them, at least they should go to counsel before they're finalised. And essentially, if there are no questions, that's it, but I'm open to questions.